Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. It's Wednesday, December 16th at 4 o'clock, just after market close here in New York. There is no intro segment today, and I'm joined by Ed Harrison. Ed, thank you so much.
Good to talk to you, Max.
All right. It's becoming a bit of a tradition for us to talk here on Wednesday. This Wednesday is a little different than other Wednesdays in that it was a Fed day, however uneventful a Fed day it was relative to some of the ones we've had more recently. Why don't we start there? I know you want to talk about the bull case for equities a little bit later, but I think it's important just to get this out of the way.
Yeah. And I want to hear what you have to say, because as you're suggesting, it seemed like it was a bit of a nothing burger. I think none of the guidance was really that changed in terms of what the Fed's going to do. They're at 0 to 0.25%. They're doing $80 billion a month in treasuries, $40 billion a month in MBS. And they're saying that, you know, this is to provide the liquidity that's necessary to deal with markets. I don't know what the exact term that they use. You know, they have a phraseology that they use. But I think it's important to recognize that they're still buying $40 billion a month of mortgage-backed securities when the housing market is actually doing really well. So to the degree that what they're trying to do is help dislocated markets provide liquidity, it's clear that that's not actually what's happening.
Did they ever actually say that they were buying mortgage-backed securities to support the housing market, or is it more about the banking system, obviously, as those are considered, you know, good collateral in some cases? Was it about the housing market or the banking system that they were buying those MBS?
Well, I mean, when they originally did QE and they started to do mortgage-backed securities, it was because the market was dislocated. That was back in 2008. Because if you remember, MBS were in a world of hurt. And so that was certainly what they were doing then. So when they started QE up here again, they use MBS in the exact same way that they did the first time. But, you know, between March, when markets actually were dislocated in general, and today, it's clear that that's not a market where there's any dislocation whatsoever. So really, they're just, you know, bigfooting that market and creating a sense of distortion by not giving people a good price signal.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they didn't really change much in terms of policy implementation. I like the end of quarter Fed days a little bit more than the intra quarter ones, because they give those summary of economic projections that they have. And not a lot of change, but it is at least interesting to look and see. You know, they give the median, they give the central tendency. Those are pretty similar to what they had back in September. I like the range, because although it isn't, you know, the consensus, it is a view that there is some potential that we won't have as much growth as the market seems to be pricing in. In September, the range for 2021 GDP number was between 0 and 5.5% growth. We got it slightly up, so a little bit rosier, but still a big range from 0.5 to 5.5. Now, central tendency is 3.7 to 5%. So most of the members of the Federal Reserve Board are seeing economic growth for next year. But there is at least a few people on the board, or maybe just one, who's pulling everything down, who don't have as rosy a view as the rest of the board. So I think that's important to remember, especially in context of what we're going to talk about now, which is the potential for continuation of this rotation trade, and maybe even a rotation of the rotation trade, which I think is pricing in the top end of that range, more towards the middle, the central tendency, and potentially even that high end of 5.5%. So
right. And, you know, maybe what the market is saying to the degree that they're pricing in that high end is that the Fed's wrong. Because what is interesting, if you look at that table one in the economic projections, which shows the central tendency that you're talking about and then the medians, and it gives you the differential between what happened in December and September, the numbers are all going up and are going in the right direction. It's saying that the Fed was too bearish in September relative to their expectations today. So change in real GDP, it was negative 2.4% this year. Now it is, or it was negative 3.7%. Now it's negative 2.4. It's 4.2 for next year instead of 4, and it's 3.2 instead of 3 for 2022. When you look at the unemployment rate, they were saying 7.6% in September for year end, but now they're saying 6.7. They're saying 5% for 2021, whereas they were saying 5.5%. And then for 2022, unemployment 4.2% versus what they originally said was 4.6%. So, I mean, my read is the Fed is saying, actually, you know, the conditions are show from a macro perspective that we can bump up the median numbers both for real GDP and unemployment, yet we're doing the exact same thing that we said that we're going to do before. To me, that shows you that there's a lot of liquidity sloshing around in the market. And so the market's taking this as a sign that the Fed is going to, you know, keep its foot onto the accelerator. And that's going to mean that the numbers could be even higher than the Fed is telling us they are.
Yeah, one number that we didn't talk about was the inflation projections, at least on Real Vision, and even more in other media outlets. You're hearing calls for inflation to come in 2021. And if you look at what the Fed is saying, the inflation targets have actually basically maintained the same, but even still, they're not hitting their 2%, which they actually want to overshoot until 2023 by their own projection. So some people here, at least on Real Vision, calling for inflation to come in 2021, Fed saying we don't even see it until 2023. So it will be interesting to see how that plays out, because many of the rotation trades that people are talking about are related to the potential for inflation to come back in 2021. So that is a bit of disconnect between what the Fed is saying and what the market is saying.
Definitely. So, you know, in terms of that rotation trade, I think that let's lay it out from the bullish side. And the reason I want to do that is because we've talked to some of the bulls recently. I've talked to Kevin Muir, who was relatively bullish, also on inflation, by the way. Rich Bernstein, he's a bull. And I spoke to Jay Polosky yesterday, who's also a bull. That interview hasn't gone up yet, but will be up next week. And they all are saying similar things in terms of rotating into things that have been underappreciated, and that this is good, what's happening in terms of the vaccine and the economy for nominal GDP, disaggregated both into real GDP and inflation. So they see inflation going up. They see nominal GDP going up as a result of real GDP also going up. And they see you wanting to get into the cyclicals, into the value stocks, into the small caps, et cetera. I think that Jay Polosky, his conversation with me was more nuanced, and that's the direction I want to head in terms of disaggregating how you want to think about this, because it's not just a buy and hold the S&P and, you know, buy the dips when the S&P corrects. It's more, there is a rotation, there is some alpha to be had, rather than just buying ETFs or buying the U.S. index.
Yeah, that's interesting. He's not the first person to say that this is an alpha market, not a beta market. You want to be thinking about security selection. You want to be thinking about quality and, in a sense, relative value, which is very interesting, because you can take relative value down all the way to relative value within the capital structure of an individual company. So, Ed, are we getting that nuance? Are we talking about capital structure arbitrage plays here, or is this individual companies within a sector, sectors within a country, different countries? I mean, there's a lot of different ways you can do relative value and think about rotation.
Yeah, I think it's all of that for a number of different reasons. And I think the first reason is that even though the premise of the bullish play is that we're going to look through the data, the reality is that there's a storm coming. You know, even though you can see the light at the end of the tunnel, there is a lot of darkness right now. And not every company is going to make it through. And some of those are going to be ones that are leveraged up, that are in the sectors that you don't want to be in, sectors that actually might have some residual negativity even after we get to the post-vaccine period. So even within those companies, there's some potential that you would be at different points in the stack of the capital structure. But the same is true also within a sector, that, you know, someone with a small good balance sheet versus someone with a bad balance sheet. I thought it was interesting, actually, from Jay Polosky's perspective, to talk about country rotation, because he's talking about DM, that is developed markets, ex-US, and moving particularly into Asia. And, you know, if you talk about ex-China for emerging markets for East Asian EM, that's also an interesting play. Here's an interesting stat. Let me just run through some of the 12-month roll-ups for different indices around the world. So the 12-month return for the NASDAQ leads the charge of the ones I've looked at, 43% over a 12-month period for the NASDAQ. And this is, you know, including the period of going down and then going back up. I'm talking about from December to December, up 43%. So that's pretty huge.
Yeah.
Then the small cap 2000, which had been lagging, is already the U.S. small cap up 19%, whereas the S&P is up 16, the Dow's up 7. You compare that then to what's happening in Europe, and what you see is a flat DAX. You see a CAC 40 in France that's down 8%, a FTSE that's down 13%, and an IBEX in Spain that's down 16%. Euro stocks overall down 7%. And then rounding it out, looking at Asia, Thailand as an example, they're down 5%. The Hang Seng's down 5%. But Japan, Nikkei is up 12%. Shanghai is up 13%. And the Kospi in South Korea is up a gargantuan 28%.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
So, but how much of that, though, Ed, is actually sector differences between the indices? Because there's a big difference in the makeup between, say, Spain, overweight, you know, lots of financials, which have not performed well. It's not just, you know, that there, it, you can't take the index in the U.S. and assume that it has basically the same composition in another country. There's only one Amazon. There's only one Apple, all of those things. But, you know, the banking sector tends, every country has their own banks. Every country has that sort of thing. And so is the difference between country rotation really just a sector rotation play with a little bit of obfuscation because the indices are country-based?
No, it's not only, but that is a very large percentage of it. I would say perhaps the majority of it. And so that's where the play is, to the degree that you think that you're going to weight towards small cap, you're going to reweight, you're going to rotate into cyclicals, you're going to rotate into growth. Well, you've already gotten 19% from the small cap 2000 in the United States. Whereas in other countries, even the larger cap companies, you haven't gotten that rotation. So as an example, you know, the IBEX 35, heavily weighted towards industrials, towards energy, towards financials. So exactly these value stocks, these cyclicals that you were talking about. Same thing, you know, for the CAC 40. Go to Asia, and what you see, for instance, I spoke to an EM professional today, Josh Ayers, about this, and he was talking to me about the differential between some of these companies or these countries. Thailand, on the one hand, they're not technology focused, whereas if you look at the Kospi, very heavy focus, you know, massive percentage for Samsung. Same thing if you look at Taiwan, you know, semiconductors. So I think that there is a play there with regard to saying that if you one of the reasons I looked at the NASDAQ, the small cap 2000, the S&P and the Dow is to say that if you look at the United States, even if you disaggregate those rotations that you're thinking about, all those numbers are up massively relative to other plays in Europe. And so then you have to ask yourself, if I'm going to rotate, am I going to continue to rotate in the United States, or am I going to do a country rotation? And I feel like the country rotation actually has more legs to it than the sector rotation, especially given the fact that we have still a very dark period to go through, and there may be some backsliding in terms of overbought, small cap and overbought rotation trades in the United States.
On top of that, you also have a potential tailwind in a weak dollar. So we still have not yet to have a stimulus come through here. There's a potential as well for, with the Georgia runoff, still for the blue wave, which would be indicative of potentially even greater stimulus coming through. And I mean, we're not there yet, but we're at 90 approximately in the dollar, and we've got two trading days left this week. We could see a dollar in the 80s before we talk again next week, Ed. And there's still plenty of other catalysts left in the coming year for more dollar weakness. Is that at all factoring into what people are looking at in terms of rotation to EM?
Yeah, and not just EM, but ex-US DM. I think that rather than thinking about it from the perspective of, let's say that these companies are more valuable and that's better for the US economy, they're looking at it from a pure sort of, these are investments that we're making in US dollars. And US dollar investments are going to be lower because we expect the dollar to be lower. So that is yet more reason to rotate out of the U.S. and to rotate into other places where the currencies are going to be stronger, because potentially the currency effect will overwhelm some of the positive. So when you look at what we're looking at in terms of, 12-month run-up, when you look at price earnings levels on a relative basis, and this is including the fact that there are differentials in what these indices are composed of. And then when you look at the currency risk associated with it, I think that the U.S. markets are looking less interesting than other markets. And, I think this is something that Jay Pulaski was talking about. His thesis is basically that you want to be you want to go away from the things that have worked over the last year. That's large cap, technology, growth, non-cyclical, and U.S. And you want to move and rotate into the things that have not run up as much. And so that's going to be ex-U.S. first and foremost, small cap, value, cyclical, and then. When I say ex-US, I'm talking developed markets. But when you talk about EM, you're talking about East Asia EM in particular.
Okay. So this is unhedged ex-US in terms of currency risk that a lot of these people are talking about.
Well, yeah. If you're a global investor, when you're thinking, where am I going to get my returns, you're unhedged in the sense that if you're invested in a basket of stocks and bonds, there's going to be currency risk associated with investing in U.S. U.S. assets. And the same is true if you're Asian and you're investing in European or U.S. assets, and vice versa, obviously, for U.S. people. So, yes, the currency is it's a consideration.
Yeah. And if you just look at what the Fed said, you will get negative real rates here in the U.S. for at least the foreseeable future. And so, Ed, you, though, generally having known what you say, we focused on the bull case. I think it's worth talking about the risks real quick, because this isn't all said and done, even with, all of the people sounding they're coming at it from different perspectives. But we are hearing this a lot. This is something that is not unique coming from Jay Pulaski airs and whatnot. And so you, though, are the one who has kind of been sounding the horn the other way. And saying that there are still risks. So I would like to touch on those just a little bit.
Yeah, so I think that you can still say that these, if, as you put it earlier in the discussion, you're talking about it relative value-wise, you don't have to have a directional call. You're saying that one thing is better than the other. And even if you take a market neutral position, you can still benefit from that relative value. But overall, market direction-wise, where the risk lies is in what happens during the so-called insolvency phase. That is, to the degree that companies with poor balance sheets, companies that are in COVID-affected industries are hurt, and also that we have a lack of we have a lack of spending, that could affect the economy over the medium term enough so that on the backside, once with the vaccine happens and we get the pent up demand from that period, we still have a shortfall that is negatively affecting these companies and their earnings growth. I think what we saw today in the terms of the retail sales numbers, for me, that was a key wake-up call for a lot of people about what happens in terms of these shutdowns and where that could go. And then the question being, you know, what sort of impact that has over the short term that could metastasize into something longer term. So that was a negative 1.1% month over month. And it was also a revision down for October to negative 0.1% month over month instead of the 0.3% up that was originally reported last month. I sort of looked at the subcomponents of this, and it's exactly what you would think in terms of the vulnerabilities. And I was looking at it just from a 11 month, you know, the entirety of 2020 perspective that we saw in retail sales compared to the entirety of 2019. And here are the numbers, what they look like. Building materials, first 11 months of 2020, 13.4% up on the first 11 months of 2019. Food and beverages, up 11.6%. Non-store retailers, you know, I don't have brick and mortars, up 22.6%. But and you know, this is what you're seeing in the markets. That's why, you know, you see that outperformance. But then you see food and service drinking places were down 19.4% year over year, 16.4% for electronics and appliance stores, for gasoline stations. Electronics and appliances were down 14%. And then, you know, a whopping 28.5% for clothing and clothing accessory stores. So let's focus in on retail right there. Commercial real estate, retail, you have a sector down 28%. How do we know, A, that that's not going to continue to be hemorrhaging over the next, say, 6 months before the vaccine is taken by everyone? And then B, how do we know that behavior hasn't been altered permanently so that those numbers never come back up, even though people are, you know, there's pent up demand and people are ready to go shopping?
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Yeah. Well, I think it's really interesting because you can have this potential negative and we can look through it, but really that being bullish doesn't mean the same thing as it did maybe 2 or 3 years ago, where being bullish meant a higher S&P 500 target. And in this case, the bullishness that we're talking about, these people maybe don't even have a higher S&P 500 target. They're bullish on these things, and it seems so foreign because the U.S. outperformance has been so exaggerated and so absolute for a period of time that you almost forget that you can be bullish without saying that the S&P 500 is going to be higher. So it's taking some getting used to even to hear those things together.
By the way, let me just tell you, in terms of the rotation trade, I personally buy into the rotation trade. This is how I would put it, is that, so we have the Moderna and we have the Pfizer vaccines, which are relatively effective, you know, 94%. J&J is coming out soon. In Europe and also in other countries, we know that there is the AstraZeneca vaccine. So, I mean, we're not talking about just one or two vaccines, potentially 3, 4, and 5 different vaccines that are available to a large number of people in developed markets. And so at some point in time, companies at workplaces, airlines, you know, hotels, they're all going to be saying, show me proof that you have the vaccine. And when they do, you're going to say to yourself, if I want to have the worry-free world that all these other people are having because they've taken the vaccine, I need to take the vaccine too. I really think vaccine adoption is going to be high, and then we're going to get to, you know, so-called herd immunity by a relatively good time, say mid-2021, and it'll be off to the races to a certain degree. So, and so therefore there is rotation there, but there will be damage done in the interim, and things won't be exactly as they were before. And that's where the downside risk resides. And so that's what you and I are talking about right now.
Okay. Well, Ed, I think that about does it for me in terms of questions I had for you. There was an interesting market anomaly that I wanted to talk about yesterday, which I think is just indicative of what is happening in markets. A stock that has been talked about on Real Vision before, Camping World, the CEO, Marcus Lemonis from The Profit, he tweeted about an EV manufacturer, didn't even tweet about his own company, and the stock went up 10%. Well, it gave back 7% today after there wasn't any news. There was nothing happening with the company. I don't think there was any major flows. But to me, that is such a great example of what algos can do in the market. And I just thought it was a very interesting thing. This is a bit of conjecture on my part. But having known that there was no news and seeing a price movement like that, it just really struck me as like that's the perfect encapsulation of what algo trading can do in a market. And I wanted to bring it up here for viewers to go take a look and look at that price action. If you're ever trying to wonder, like, what does algo trades driving the market, like, what does it look like? That to me is the encapsulation. So that was the only thing I wanted to talk about today.
You know, there was one other thing that I wanted to talk about, actually, at random. I was just looking right before we came on at Wish. I don't know if you saw that Wish Shopping. Mm-hmm. They did an IPO today. So it was like the, you know, we had Airbnb that did really well. We had DoorDash that went really well. They were up like 100%, 89%. Wish was down today. I think that the IPO busted. It was down, you know, 20%, something of that order. Very interesting. You look like you didn't hear about this. So maybe we can get something in the comments if anyone has anything to say about that. But I think that there's a lot of IPO activity going on along with what you're talking about, Max. It does say that, you know, there's something going on in terms of the zeitgeist right now. I think that we're at a pivotal time. It's interesting to see, you know, where sentiment is headed.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this has certainly been a narrative-driven market, and you have to be paying attention to when the narratives have shifted. And in terms of those IPOs, I mean, there was significant noise around perhaps the frothiness surrounding them. And if you get enough noise about that type of stuff, the narrative can shift. And perhaps Airbnb and DoorDash just happened to get in before the narrative shifted, and perhaps themselves were the cause of that narrative shift. So in a narrative-driven market, you have to keep your ear to the ground.
All right. I think maybe we'll leave it at that for today. It was great to talk to you as usual.
All right. Yeah, lots of fun, Ed. Look forward to do it again soon.